Welcome to the Wired for Success podcast, your show for ambitious, mission-driven entrepreneurs who want to build million-dollar businesses without sacrificing their health, relationships, or happiness, who understand that in order to build their empire, they need a solid foundation, and that the more they are thriving, the more their business is thriving too. This show brings you the very best from science, self-development, and entrepreneurship to set you up for sustainable success. Hi, I'm Claudia Garbutt, the scientist turned mindset and high performance coach for entrepreneurs, and I help you get wired for success. Hey everyone, and welcome back to a brand new episode of the Wired for Success podcast, where we talk about all things science, self-development, and entrepreneurship that help you get to that next level of success in your life and business. My guest today is 83-year-old entrepreneur John A. Brink. John was born in 1940 in Nazi-occupied Holland during the Second World War. From the time he could walk, his days often consisted of foraging for food with his brother and sister during harsh, warlike conditions, surrounded by death and hardship, especially during the hunger winter of 1944-45. John's mother was left to raise their three kids alone when their father was drafted into the Dutch army, and they wouldn't know if he was dead or alive until the liberation of their village by Canadian soldiers on April 12, 1945. And that was the exact moment when little five-year-old John decided he would one day move to Canada, the land of his heroes. Like many others who lived through that time, John has lived his entire life with the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder resulting from being in a war zone. And despite those hardships, at age 83, John continues to succeed in his role as president and CEO of the Brink Group of Companies and 10 plus other companies. John is the author of three books and the host of the On the Brink podcast series. He's also a fierce advocate for erasing the stigma around ADHD, something John has lived with his entire life. So welcome, John, and thank you so much for being on my show today.
Yeah, nice to be with you, Claudia. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Now, John, it sounds like you've had a very traumatic childhood, and I can only imagine what that must have been like. Would you mind sharing some of those early memories with us? What was your childhood like, and how have those experiences shaped the person that you have become?
Yeah, that's obviously a very appropriate question, considering that, you know, I grew up during the war years, born in 1940. And I remember, you know, from the time that I was 3.5, 4 years old, the first things that comes to mind is all the bombers overhead, the Allied bombers that were bombing then Germany. And we were, living in the northeastern part of Holland in a province called Groningen. And that is within 10 or 15 minutes from the German border. We used to, what I remember is in the evenings, we would go outside, look at the deck behind our bedrooms upstairs and look at the sky, see all the planes. The reason that we did, the sound of hundreds of planes in the air is still something I remember that I likely will never hear again, is that of the Allied bombers, daytime, nighttime bombing. The reason that we went outside is because my mother felt safer being outside than inside. And the distance we could see cities in Germany burning in the distance, Bremen, Hamburg, and Kiel, and all those others in the very distance, we saw the sky being red. And so I remember that part very well. And then obviously I remember, as you already indicated, the hunger winter of 1944-45, which was a very, very difficult time where there was no food, nothing to eat. And it was the coldest winter on record. I still remember that. In fact, I still can feel even now the feeling of hunger. I still can feel that from nearly 79, 80 years ago. The other part that I still feel now is the immense cold. We had a little stove in a very small part of our house, but that my mom tried to keep warm, and we were sitting around that to stay warm. And then the other part that had an impact on me is that, and I got actually counseling for that, not only PTSD, but also the inner child, is the fear of losing that one parent that we had. I got counseling for that actually in my 50s, very emotional actually. And, you know, so those are the things that I remember. And then doing the, you know, the towards the end of the war, we were liberated by the Canadians or the Allied force, in particular the Canadians, in April of 1945. And as you can already imagine, and the people watching us already can imagine, that northeastern Holland was close to the border. Obviously, the Allied forces landed in Normandy and pushed their way through Belgium, France, Belgium, through Holland, along the coastline and to the north, and pushed the what was left of the German armies back into Germany. By then, obviously, the German army didn't have much left, and it became very difficult what they were doing, the German army, to slow down the liberating forces. They blew up all the bridges behind them, including a bridge in front of our house. And I still remember laying in the crawl space underneath our floor, looking through a little window and the grid underneath the front door, and with pillows against my head when they were blowing up the bridge. And so I remember that. And then after they were liberated, saw far too much that we should not have seen, dead bodies and people being shot. And then when, you know, the no man's land happened, before the Canadians were in, the Germans were gone, then the underground collected the collaborators, and bad things happened there as well. And saw far too much of those kind of things. The other thing I want to always hasten to add is that we had no, afterwards, no bad feelings towards the Germans. They were caught into a dictatorship by Adolf Hitler, and the Europeans that were being held captive, were victims, but so were the German people, became victims of this war. And very quickly after the war, there was interaction again across the border. And if we look today, obviously, but we remember the war years, and looking around the world in particular, collectively, we look at the Ukraine, the Middle East, and the other places, then war is bad. I remember it, you know, I was affected by it for next generation, in some cases two generations, for those people that think that, respectfully, that if there is war, once the war is over, everything goes back to normal. It simply doesn't. That's not how it works. It should be avoided at all costs. And there is the effects of the war years, like in our family, affected my family and my parents, obviously, but also their kids. And as I indicated, even now, as a five-year-old that saw it all, I can still feel it now, and the effect of the war. So, and then the other part is obviously the difference between democratic rule and a dictatorship. Adolf Hitler is an example that we see around the world. Putin is an example. China is an example. North Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, and Iran, obviously, and those kind of places. All those are bad, you know, for the people that live there, and will pay the price for dictators that become overambitious and trying to. Hungary is another one going in that direction. So it's very scary, actually, you know.
Yeah, it totally is. So I hope that we can avoid some of those terrible consequences for all the people around the world. But what would you say, how have those experiences shaped the person that you have become? Can you look back and see that they made you stronger in some sense? Or how do you think about those times?
So if I look at that, Claudia, it's likely that I remember well the liberation by the Canadian Army, April the 12th, 1945. I was nearly four and a half, five years old. I remember when they came in and we had no food. There was a little section of the Canadian Army behind our house, 20 feet away, 20 meters away, I should say. And we would go there as kids every morning, and they would feed us with bread, and the bread had butter and cheese, and the cheese and the butter was bigger than the bread. And everybody was called Johnny, although we didn't speak the language, but anyway, we did, obviously. And so it made such an impression on me that I knew from that point forward, I would go to, as soon as I could, to the land of my heroes, Canada. And I tried to go when I was 17, and my parents wouldn't let me then. And then I was drafted into the Dutch Air Force for about 2 years. And then worked in the forest industry in Holland. My dad managed a small lumber company, and my grandfather was a master carpenter. I knew I would want to go to Canada. And then the other thing that I wanted to do, I wanted to build my own lumber company. Now, the other part that is probably quite important is that I was academically not very successful. I failed grade 3 and I failed grade 7 3 times. And kids can be very hard on each other. And so that after I failed grade 7 the third time, my parents said, okay, well, what are we going to do with this guy? Some people said, send him to the mentally challenged school. Well, they did. We're not going to do that. But maybe get him to learn a trade of some sort. And they thought maybe a furniture maker. So at 13, I started working in a furniture factory. And then a lot of kids that had gone to school with me that had now gone to college and to the university, they looked at me, and all of a sudden the people that were friends at one point looked at me like I was a laborer. I'm proud of that today, but then it was not looked at all that favorably. And so, the dream came back that I wanted to go to Canada and already worked in the forest industry, became a furniture maker. And then I wanted to start my own business to prove to me that I was just as smart as the other people, guys and girls were, that went to college and university, and to prove it to not them, but to me, that I could do that. So I wanted to start to go to Canada. Obviously, that was my dream when I was 23. I had a suitcase, 3 books, 2 sets of clothes, and I took $150 Canadian with me when I left Schiphol, flew into Montreal, Canada, took the train across Canada. It's a long way, 4 days, 5 nights. Came to Vancouver, went to the immigration office there. Fortunately, I couldn't speak English. Fortunately, at the immigration office, there was one fellow, he was German. I could speak some German, and I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, I told him I wanted to build a lumber company. He said, go to Prince George. Now, where is Prince George? Our guests will ask. Most of them know British Columbia, Canada. It's a beautiful, beautiful province, big province. Vancouver is well known, and Victoria, but Vancouver, Prince George is about 500 miles or 800 kilometers north of Vancouver. And so that is exactly in the middle of the province, north to south, east to west. So that's where we are today. That's where I've been for 60 years. And so when I came here then, when I was 23, followed the advice of the German fellow that gave me direction, stepped in the Greyhound bus, 12, 13 hours, came to Prince George. With my suitcase, my 3 books, 2 sets of clothes, and I counted my money at least 3 times, and I had exactly $25.47.
Oh, wow.
But I had lots of this attitude. No matter how tough today is, I always know that tomorrow will be a better day. I avoid negative. I don't like to listen to people that are negative. And the other part is passion. Whatever I do, I give it 150%. And the other part of my foundation is work ethic. I work harder than anybody. Even now, still at 83, nearly 84, I get up at 5:30 in the morning, and I always think I'm late. I always make my bed, and then I'm always in a hurry, and work usually 12, 14 hours a day, and that's what I do. And obviously, since I came here with my 25, 47, my dream was to build my own lumber company. I did that, and then quite a number of other companies, and have been quite successful, obviously. And then, you know, the other part that you may find very interesting is that I still didn't, even when I was successful here, a lot of people said, oh, you're so successful. I didn't feel that way.
Hmm.
I was still struggling with that issue. And until it was January 1997 that I walked into a bookstore here in Prince George, picked up a book. I still don't know why. The book's title was Driven to Distraction, written by Dr. Halliwell. And as I still don't know why I did, I opened the book and I started looking at it, and it talked about ADHD. And I said, oh my God, that's me. And so I wrote in the book in Dutch because I was ashamed of it. Now I finally know who I am. And so, you know, I took the book, obviously bought the book, and then started researching ADHD. And the more I found out about it, you know, that that the frequency of occurrence is at least 8% between males and females around the world. And I started to look more and more, and then found that the frequency of occurrence likely was much higher than that. And then, now the interesting part is that I've done about 232, 235 podcasts on the brink. Podcast number 203, actually, is all on YouTube and all over the place, is an interview with Dr. Halliwell that wrote that book in 2093. I bought it in 2097, and it changed my life. So as him and myself, we talked, and I said to him, at least in my opinion, the frequency of occurrence is likely more than 20%. He said, no, John, it's more than 25%.
Oh,
the other part that we talked about is saying among entrepreneurs, in my experience, is that I believe, I said to Dr. Halliwell, is that the frequency of occurrence of ADHD among successful is the operative here. Successful entrepreneurs and CEO is likely, I said, more than 50%. He said, no, John, more than 75%.
Mm.
And I believe that. So that kind of changed my life. And then, you know, I was not an outgoing speaker. I was still very conscientious of myself. So I followed Toastmasters, and I don't know if you're familiar with that at all. It is an organization that probably started in North America, but also in Europe to a certain extent, that focuses on public speaking and communications in a general sense. And I was quite concerned. It was my ex-sister-in-law that dragged me down there and said, hey, John, come with me to Toastmasters. And look at it. I said, what are you going to do? Are you going to ask me any questions? He said, no, you just sit there and you listen. Well, as soon as I sit down and I wait for a while, then all of a sudden somebody said, hey, John, tell us all about you. And I said, oh, my God, I'll never go back here. I stayed there for 10 years and became a distinguished Toastmaster. What does that mean? Like as we speak now, there is probably 500,000 people around the world that are actively involved in Toastmasters. It's on the line on Google's what they do. And probably over the last 20, 30, 40 years, probably 10 million people have participated in some extension of Toastmasters. The highest level you can get to in Toastmasters, if you wish, or if you desire to do that, is a distinguished Toastmaster. There's probably less than 0.5% of the 10 million that go to that level. I did. And it changed my life between ADHD and Toastmasters. I became a late bloomer at in my 60s. I started become an in-demand keynote speaker, and then started writing books. I have three of them. The one is Against All Odds. It's about not how successful John is, but how the challenges along the way. Then the second book that I wrote is the one about my favorite topic, ADHD Unlocked. And not only applies to ADHD people, but also to people that have been affected by trauma. Mm-hmm. And the frequency of occurrence and slow learning or attention issues are so widespread that I say that for virtually anybody, will encounter in their family, in their friend circles, or somewhere around their circle, they will interact with ADHD-related issues. So I say, read it, buy a book, not only mine, but other ones in the marketplace, and understand them, because they tend to be, people with ADHD tend to be somewhat different in a positive way. I call it a superpower. And then the other book that I did is, I find so many people don't like what they're doing. I know people in their 40s, and you probably do 30s, 40s, they hate their job. And I say, change, because you take that home with you. Everything around you will be affected by it. Or younger people that go to college or university, when I give presentations to them, I always ask, have you thought about what to do for a career or whatever? And say, not really, no. I don't know what I'm going to do. I say, the more exposure you can get to potential career directions, the better. So you want to be a carpenter, talk to people that are carpenters. You want to be a truck driver, talk to people that drive trucks and see what it is. Or you want to be a lawyer, or you want to be a doctor, or you want whatever choice you, but get a feeling of what careers, or an entrepreneur for that matter, or a consultant or whatever. Then the more you understand about it, the more clearer you are about the choices that are A, suitable for you and that you may like. So I felt I had to write a book about it. So the book is Finding Your Passion, Living the Dream. Is saying that find that job so that you do like me. I get up. I said, don't get up at 5:30. I do. But at least every morning you will have pleasure in doing what you do. And then I'm working on my fourth one that you may find interesting. I believe always that health is critical. Mm-hmm. It's just a number. But quality of life is the critical part. So I'm writing a book about that comes out in August. Living young, dying old. And the picture is actually me. I'm also the oldest competitive bodybuilder in North America. And, yeah. So this one comes out in August. And so that kind of gives you a little bit of background on who I am, in addition to what you already shared. Yes.
Thank you so much for sharing. Super impressive. Now, I want to go back to some of the things you said and just follow up on some of those aspects. Now, you were still, as you said, very young when you had all those traumatic early experiences. And then I assume that when you're a child, you don't really realize that you're suffering from PTSD because you don't even know what that is. So when did you realize that you suffered from PTSD and what impact did it have on your life?
Yeah, so, and that's the correct observation, Claudia, because if you grow up in war, it's war, right? But what you do realize is that you have hunger, and that it is very, very cold, and that people dying around you. And, and then every morning, my brother, my sister, and myself, we would go into the railroad yard with gunny sacks and pick up anything edible and burnable. But always we had the feeling of cold and hunger that I remember. And probably the one thing that in particular affected me was the anxiety of losing my mother, and then seeing that so many people around us were picked up and brought to Germany, either because they were Jews and never came back, or otherwise they were picked up, they needed it for working camps that they had set up. And so the whole environment was changed. And then seeing dead bodies left an impression on me, but still stands in my mind, is seeing a wagon with legs and arms hanging out, and people that were being shot, and then a neighbor that got a bullet through his head and was hanging out the window that we saw. All that kind of stuff directly, indirectly stayed with me, but I never knew what it meant, but it still stayed with me. And obviously it was the after effects of PTSD. And, it made me better understand. Fortunately, the inner child, something that maybe is not respectfully well understood by a lot of people, but the fear of losing that parent that always stayed with you, because what it would mean that everybody during war years is trying to survive themselves and the people that they love and around them. But if they are so busy with all of those things, that if you would lose that one parent, you'd be on your own. And, and that feeling with death all very close by was all something cumulative that would be part of that lingering and ongoing PTSD. You know, there is no question in my mind, and I was in the Army, obviously, and the Special Forces, actually during my 2 years when I was drafted, and knowing that death is very close to you if you're in the Army or Special Forces. And then I had seen that already during my 5 years and the after effects, that it had, is that it made us all realize how vulnerable we are. But I did not realize the effect of the inner child until doing counseling, actually, and with my now wife, but then still my girlfriend, was that we had challenges in our relationship. And then the counselor said, to both of us, maybe I should talk to John about some issues around the inner child. And so I had no idea what it was about, but when we did, it was extremely emotional in that was unresolved issues. That little boy still lived there.
Such important work. So was counseling what helped you make peace with your past and overcome PTSD, or do you still have some triggers that take you back to that time?
Yeah, very good question, Claudia. You know, the one thing that I know for sure, and I always say, and I said to you earlier, is that we were all victims. You know,
right.
It was not, the bad Germans. They were all victims. It was tolerating dictatorships, that are we see all around us. And I don't have to remind you about Putin and Hungary potentially and other places. So it's always on my mind there. And the other part is that I believe I have an obligation to speak about this. On the Remembrance Day, the week of the Remembrance Day, November the 11th, I always make it a point, I've done for the last 10, 12 years, that I speak to at least 2 to 4 schools, young people, about why the 2 minutes of silence? What does it really mean? And what should it mean to us? So I speak about it. It's probably still one of the more difficult things for me to speak about.
It's so important.
Yeah.
I mean, I always say that our experiences can either make us or break us. So what are your best tips for becoming as resilient as you are?
Not a very good question. Is that I'm an optimist. You know, and I fly around a lot now because of our businesses, keeping things in perspective, you know, so, you know, the always respect others and appreciate, give back to the community. And, you know, so those things are important. And, you know, and then when I fly around in planes, I'm also a pilot, but in commercial planes in particular, when I fly around, I always sit by the window. I look outside and say, it's paradise in North America and in Canada in particular, you know. So I probably appreciate every day, you know, so of that. I'm fortunate. Money to me doesn't mean much other than it provides me a living, but to me, making a lot of money is not a priority. It's, you know, I like to, you know, be able to buy groceries and kind of live reasonably well. But we have horses, we ride horses, we like to do that and, you know, enjoy life, you know, so as much as we can. And then I'm a hard worker. I love my companies. I love to be active, as I said, in the community and association. So, and I'm an optimist. So my foundation is attitude, passion, work ethic.
Sounds like a good mix. Now, coming back to all the companies that you've founded or that you're a part of, what have you learned about entrepreneurship over the years? Do you have any best tips that you would like to share today?
Yes, I do. Is that the sooner, and that kind of comes to this, finding your passion, living the dream, is that I always knew that I liked lumber because my grandfather was a master carpenter. My dad worked in a small lumber company. And I liked lumber. I had been exposed to that. And so then I was lucky in a way, you know, that, you know, you may find this interesting. A lot of people say to me, are you still bothered by the fact that you left formal education at grade 7? And I said, yeah, it really, really still bothers me even today. And they would say, why? I said, well, I should have quit earlier. The point that I'm making is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, obviously. But the reason that what I'm saying is that I learned a lot of my foundation for business other than to the structure of schooling. And I always had this interest of listening to good speakers about topics that interested me, in particular business, even already from a young age. And if you ask me, you know, so, hey, John, to get a kind of an idea about that, what are the three books that you took with you from Holland when you in your suitcase? I say the first one was Management by Drucker, very well-known management writer and understanding teaching management, and a very, very thoughtful, very progressive individual, very popular. The other one was Logical Thinking, all in Dutch, and that to me was a very foundation. And the other one was about Canada, and so I've always followed that particular track, is learning about what motivates successful entrepreneurs, in particular people in business, not all in business necessarily, but entrepreneurs in a general sense, what made them successful is staying the course, understanding logic and having the ability to look forward. And if you say to me, what is the benefit that I have over a lot of other people, is the fact that most of my skill sets for business I learned outside of the formal structure. That's not to say that I'm against that, but if I see the universities that teach business in some form or fashion, they tend to teach it in a certain box that show you what to do when you do this and the other things. I didn't do that, and what makes me sometimes as an individual uncomfortable to the people that have taught in that structure is that I tend to go outside of that box. I know the box, I know all the things, but I look outside of it, say, what can we do? What happens here? What happens there? So I do that all the time. That is part of who I am. The other part about it is that I believe I have the quality of looking forward strategically. I look forward 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Even at 83, you would ask, yeah, I want to be 120. So I'm going to be around for a while. I'm just tongue in cheek. But that's what I do. And I have that ability. There are a lot of people that are CEOs or entrepreneurs, but in particular in CEOs, are accountable on a quarter to quarterly basis on profitability. They, in a lot of cases, are fearing major directional changes that may have to take place from time to time, where in my case, all of my companies, I'm the sole owner. I like it that way because it gives me the ability to move quickly where other people can't. And that's the advantage. You know, I've been there, I've done it. And this one, Against All Odds, would show you all the way through all the ups and downs, falling down, where other people would have given up a long time ago. I don't, you know, go forward, stay the course, you know. And so that's what Against All Odds is all about. And then recognizing the other parts in terms of, am I still struggling with PTSD? No, I've reconciled that. And I believe I should speak about issues. Dictatorships is one, and the other one is for younger people, you know, to appreciate what they have, what they give back to the community, and staying positive and those kind of things. And then stay fit. You know, there are no secrets to it. Don't be abusive to your body. You only have one of them. It's extremely forgiving, but you cannot abuse it. And, you know, and that part is important. After this podcast is over, I'm rushing to the gym because, you know, I'm going to compete again in bodybuilding and physique and the Arnolds in 2025. And I'm 85. Ooh.
That's amazing.
I'm going to win.
Of course you will. Now, I want to hear more about that. As you said, you're 83 and you're still going strong. And that is something that a lot of people aspire to, but many fall short. So what's your secret for staying sharp and healthy? What does your typical day look like?
Well, right now I get up at 5:30. I'm usually the first one at the mill and the last one to leave at my office. That's fairly normal for me. We go from meeting to meetings, from crisis to crisis, solving problems, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But I just kind of take it in course. And then, so like today, I know already I got here at 6:30, I think, and our time. And so I've had already a couple of meetings. I do my emails. I deal with some issues and problems, I lay out what I'm going to do today. Obviously, I was being a host on podcasting with you. And then after that, I go to the gym. Then I got lunch. I don't eat much for lunch. That's part of my diet secret. And then right after that, I have two or three other meetings. And then I'm working on another book here that that is coming out on August. We are in the final drafting part of that. We're going to finish that off. And then by the time I go home, it's probably 6 or 7 o'clock, you know, so and that's about it. And I try to sleep. Sleep is very important. I try to sleep 7 or 8 hours a day.
Yeah, that's very important. What does your diet look like?
My diet in the morning, I have 3 or 4 eggs, soft boiled. I usually have avocado. If it is a big one, I have a half of one. And then, you know, mid morning, I may have a protein drink that is, you know, the, we call it Boost here, but it's a healthy and drink. And then I go podcast. I have another protein drink after my podcast. And then mid afternoon, again, I have a protein drink. And then in the evening, I have usually plant-based diet, you know. And so I'm a vegan, probably 90-10 or 80-20. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very, very careful about what I eat.
So lots of protein.
Correct.
Which also helps with muscle
strength
for your competition, I guess.
Exactly. Then the closer we get to competition, the tighter my diet becomes, making sure that I'm in the right shape.
Right. And you're doing mostly strength training, or what does your exercise routine look like?
So, usually Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays, I do lower body, upper body, and then general workout as well. So I work with a trainer. The other part that I should say, Claudia, is that we all probably fall in the same category. I was not very good at staying fit and healthy initially, and then I got a shock in 2008. I got a case of diverticulitis. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it is an large colon. But I say always, if you have pain on your left side, it's probably, I'm not a doc, but I'm just saying, it's probably your appendix. If you're on the left side, it could be diverticulitis, your colon. And so extremely painful. It had ruptured in the toxins. If you need to get it fixed very, very quickly if it breached. And so I have a high threshold for pain. It took me 48 hours before I got to a doc. And by the time I got there, got me in the hospital, took 20 centimeters out of my colon. And that was in 2008, but I came that close. So it gave me a shock. I knew I had to take health and fitness much more serious. My wife is vegan, and she is very particular and tried to get me to go, but not as quickly as I should have, likely. But in any event, so that was the shock that got me to the point that I say, we all do the same here, and probably in your life, they do the same. It's at the end of the year, we say, we're going to do this, that, and the other thing, and then we're also going to buy a membership to the gym. And we do that for 2 weeks, and then we can find 100 reasons why we can't go anymore. And then next year, we do the same. So I knew I had to take this more serious. So I started working with a trainer. And then after about 6 years of training and being very serious about 6-7 years, somebody said to us when I was training, he said, have you ever thought about competing? Mm-hmm. I said, well, I was already in my 70s. And I said, me? And then they said, well, why not? So I did that and started competing. First in Northern BC, did well, came in second and third in physique. And then provincially, again, the same. Then nationally qualified for the Nationals and for the Arnold Schwarzenegger's annual. And so I did that. And then obviously COVID came. And now again, I'm actively involved. So the point that I'm making is that since that time, I take my diet much more serious and fitness much more serious. I like it, and I enjoy it, and the key to having a healthy diet, all the information is available. Once you get used to it and you start understanding it, and part of that is in our book that's coming out in August, Living Young, Dying Old. It's all about that. It's not the number, but it's quality of life, and that means taking care of this body that is so forgiving, but only to a certain extent. And most people, especially the last decade, is usually difficult. I want to make sure that there is no reason. I saw on CNN or one of the other big channels, I heard that a doc examined 100,000 biopsies of people and to find the reason as to why they died. Not a single one of them died because of old age. Well, that gets attention, So, so in any event, so I believe that our book, Living Young, Dying Old, addresses that issue. There is no reason that we cannot be 100, and there's no reason that we cannot be fit. I can run circles around most of the people around me, and I stay active, and I'm going to be in November 84. And I'll be competing in the Arnolds when I'm 85.
It's so inspiring. That's amazing. I totally believe in the same things. Like, you have to stay active throughout your life. I mean, some people say, as we get older, we decline simply because most people just stop moving, right? Because they just start sitting around doing nothing. And when you do that, then it goes downhill pretty quickly. But if you stay active and you still exercise and you keep a healthy diet, then you can increase that health span that is so important. Not just your lifespan, your health span.
And I think that's why it is so important. That's why I'm writing the book. And so if I look back and now and saying that, you know, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing and saying, what is this guy doing that is so magic that keeps him in the shape that he is and that keeps him doing this? It's fairly simple. I have decided I'm not old, you know, so I'm going to stay fit and I do what it takes. Is that hard work? No, it isn't. That you can start with walk at least 20 minutes a day. Not difficult. Start thinking about diet, understand what you're eating, processed foods. If you don't understand exactly what is in it, don't eat it. When I go into a grocery store, I stay on the outside. I look at plant-based diets, you know, so and start with that. Go, you know, stay active for 20 minutes and start looking at your diet. Don't drink, don't smoke, don't do all that other stuff. And I don't do that and I enjoy it. And then from there and then stay positive, sleep well. Sleep is extremely important. Sleep at least 7 or 8 hours a night. And then once you start there and then read my book, some of the other things that I'm doing, I'm not a doc, obviously. I'm simply telling you what normal people can do. And then all of a sudden they feel better. They get up in the morning and they like to go to work. And it's not, I have friends that are in the late 40s or in the 40s are laying on the couch and saying, I'm done. I'm too old now. So if that's what you decide, that's what you will be.
Yeah, I know. It's not rocket science, but you have to be consistent. I think that's just the key. Now, before we go, where can our listeners find you online if they would like to learn more about you or connect with you?
johnabrank.com.
Fantastic. John, thank you so much for talking and for sharing your wisdom with us today. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks, Claudia. It was a privilege. And you take care.
Take care and talk soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Wired for Success podcast. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and leave a review. That's a fantastic, easy, and zero-cost way to help the show grow. Just use the link in the show notes and make my day. Want more? For quick, actionable tips and insights to guided meditations and a side of biohacking, join my inner circle and get access to exclusive subscriber-only content. Again, just use the link in the show notes to join the tribe. Thank you for your support and see you on the other side. Take care and talk soon. Bye.